This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector. Investigative conversations about issues that impact our lives. Be curious. Friday mornings at 9 a.m. only on 101.9 High FM.
We are live. Okay. And this is The Deep Dive. And I'm Brooke Spector, your usual host here on Friday mornings. And my guest, somebody we turn to periodically to help us to cast some light into the dark abyss of American politics. And this, of course, is David Swallow. We actually have two folks we call upon. We try not to overuse our friendships. David Smith, the Guardian Washington correspondent. And we like David because he spent years in Africa. And so he has this wonderful comparative basis to be able to explain the mysteries of America to people with an understanding of what people in Africa need to understand, need to have explained. And he brings his wit and insight to us every once in a while. And here we are just a couple days before the inauguration of a new president, an old president in a new inauguration, I guess. There's always this argument about whether he's the 45th and 47th president or simply the 45th president. And this goes back to Grover Cleveland's time when he also served two non-continuous terms. I guess the answer is, well, he was still the same person, so he just skipped 4 years. But I want to talk to David, not just about the inauguration and the lead up to it, which is on Monday, but the confirmation hearings that have been going on for members of the Trump cabinet. And of course, there is something else that's been happening in the world that's important to our listeners, and that's the ceasefire agreement in the Middle East, which is supposed to kick off for real on Sunday. And that has held the world's attention for sure. David, it's good to have you with us again.
Great to be here. And we're at another turning point. Joe Biden's heading for the exit. Donald Trump's coming in. And as you say, this is only the second time in history we've actually had a former president returning. And it's going to sort of just add to that trivia question of you know, how many men have actually been president? I think the answer will be 45, even though Donald Trump will be the 47th president. It gets very confusing mathematically.
Well, yeah, I mean, because then the cynics will say, well, Franklin Roosevelt served four times. Does that make him the 29th, 30th, 31st, and 32nd president?
Yeah, that's a fair question. The great fear, of course, is that Donald Trump will seek to emulate him and go for a third or even fourth term, which sounds like a joke, but this is the man who led the January the 6th insurrection. And, you hear some more extreme Republicans saying, let's change the Constitution and allow Donald Trump to run yet again. But time will tell on that one.
He'll be in his early 80s. That would be a test of the cognition, not just of the candidate, but of the electorate, I would suspect, if that were to happen. I mean, you know, changing the Constitution, it takes a little bit of time, energy, and effort on the part of politicians. You have to get members of state legislatures across the country to agree with it. Then you have to have a convention, and that goes on. Not enough time between now and January, what would that year be? 25, January the 29th, 2029, I don't think, but, you know, my crystal ball is not real good right now. The lead up to the inauguration, which is, as we say, on Monday, which is also Martin Luther King Day, interestingly, the holiday that was proclaimed not so very long ago in honor of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. But the confirmation hearings for the president's cabinet members, Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, Homeland Security, et cetera, they have already been ongoing because the new Senate, the newly elected Senate, let's put it that way, began serving earlier this month. And so far, there have been interesting versions of the hearings. One was the man who has been selected to be the nominee for the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, which was a rowdy, not particularly inspiring Senate confirmation hearing, in which my personal moment of fascination was when he faced off against Senator Tammy Duckworth, who was a wounded, disabled veteran helicopter pilot, and she basically smacked him about the head and shoulders for being less than he purports to be. But then there was the hearing for Senator Marco Rubio, who would be the Secretary of State, which was, by contrast, flowers, birds twittering, and butterflies flying about. The comparison was compelling. How would you react to all that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a sign of how the Overton window has shifted in a way that at least some of these nominees who would once have seemed extreme and unlikely to pass muster with, you know, the Republican Party now are embraced. And just to go back a few weeks, the great outlier was Matt Gaetz, who was nominated for Attorney General. Not even he could get through. He was plagued by tremendous scandals, allegations of having sex with underage girls and so on, and drug use. And that was torpedoed. And there was a theory at the time, well, he might be an outlier, and he will allow Republicans to flex a few muscles and demonstrate their independence from Donald Trump. But once he's shot down, then everybody else looks relatively conventional and modest by comparison, and Republicans will not dare take down a second nominee. And it may be going in that direction. And the prime example of this is Pete Hegseth, who you mentioned, nominee for defense secretary. Again, a few weeks ago, his nomination seemed to be in big trouble. He's a former Fox News TV host and a military veteran. We already knew allegations about him running a military charity almost into bankruptcy. Just the sheer fact that he has very little experience of managing any kind of agency. Certainly not the biggest bureaucracy in the world at the Pentagon. And on top of all of that, there were new and very disturbing allegations accusing him of sexually abusing women. And yet, in recent days and weeks, there's been a shift. I think the Trump team have done their work. They've demanded total loyalty from Republican senators. And all indications are that Hegseth is going to make it. Interesting, a few little rules have been tweaked to spare him some of the scrutiny in the Senate hearing. And yes, you did hear Democrats landing a few blows on him, quizzing him about everything from his lack of experience to his womanizing, his extramarital affairs, some of these other allegations. Certainly, you know, uncomfortable viewing for him in that moment, but Republicans who have the majority stuck with him. And crucially, that same day, we heard that Senator Joni Ernst, herself a military veteran, herself very concerned with issues of sexual harassment, she said she was a yes vote for Hegseth. And apparently all the indications are that he is going to sail through. So too probably Pam Bondi for Attorney General. Again, just a few years ago, she would have been seen as somewhat extreme. Now she's in the MAGA mainstream, so to speak. And then you have someone like Marco Rubio, who compared to all of those now seems kind of highly conventional, and there's almost a sort of collective sigh of relief, even amongst Democrats, that he's a fairly ordinary Republican, whatever that means now, and you know, relatively well respected. Yeah, it's going well for Trump and Republicans. It would appear most of these nominees are going to get through. I think the big outstanding question mark right now is Tulsi Gabbard for Director of National Intelligence. Interestingly, Mitch McConnell, former Senate Majority Leader, maybe renewing his hostilities to Trump by right now he's not saying how he will vote on Gabbard. Lots of questions over her apparently favorable comments on Assad in Syria in the past and other statements she's made. We'll have to see how that goes.
David, I'm going to have to break in. We have to do one of those commercial messages, which radio stations depend on, make our audiences appreciate our sponsors and station identification and all those useful things.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
We're not back yet, are we? Okay, now we're back. We are back. This is the Deep Dive, as it says. I'm Brooke Spector, your host, and my guest, happily for us, David Smith, the Washington correspondent of The Guardian, who we periodically go to for insight into what in the world is happening to America. Even he is mystified by it sometimes, I fear, but we've been talking about Senate confirmation hearings. And one of the things that is easy to forget if you're living outside the United States, or perhaps even if you are an American in the U.S., is that the confirmation hearings and the votes on the individual cabinet members are the purview of the Senate, 100 members. Right now, there are 53 Republicans and 47 Democrats. And so that means any one of the cabinet posts, any one of the nominees has to get at least 51 votes. That would mean the Democrats, if they were united, would be able to convince three, maybe four senators who were Republican not to vote for one of Trump's picks. Usually, it doesn't split exactly on party lines, but now it looks like it's almost lockstep, almost like a parliamentary democracy where there's a whip hand that controls who's going to vote for whom. Is this a real change in America, or is this just another one of the Trump effects?
No, I think, just to give you one very fresh example, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee has just been replaced. Frankly, whether officially or not, at the behest of Donald Trump, the outgoing chairman, I think his name is Mike Turner, was actually pretty right wing. I mean, he said a lot of things that Trump would agree with, but even he fell short of the ultimate loyalty test. He was not quite Trumpy enough. And so House Speaker Mike Johnson has replaced him with someone even more MAGA, so to speak, even more Trumpy. Someone who voted against funding for Ukraine, for example. And I think that symbolizes how, Congress has lost a large degree of its independence, especially in the Trump era. Republicans in Congress are just doing Trump's bidding, frankly. And that's very different from the old days when Congress would turn around and say, hey, you as president, concentrate on what you're doing at the White House. We're doing our thing over here at the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue. They would quite relish flexing the independence of a separate branch of government. Historically, you would have a Democratic Congress, laying down the law to a Democratic president, or a Republican Congress defying a Republican president on various issues. But yes, that is yet another thing that's changed. I think, especially on the Trump and Republican side, this party is shaped in Trump's image. It's more loyal to him than ever, and that's one of the reasons why people fear an imperial presidency, an American Caesar. In that Trump will bend the Republican Party to his will with very little pushback, along with all the other things that are capitulating and going his way.
I was. You mentioned American Caesar, and the image, of course, that was crossing my mind was the last days of the Roman Republic, an increasingly ineffectual Senate being almost bludgeoned into supporting whoever the current emperor was, and that obviously is not a useful or pretty picture if you support democratic values. But can we just shift our direction a little bit? What do you expect Donald Trump to deliver in the way of an inaugural address come Monday when you're sitting outside in the freezing cold in winter where there may well be more snow or hail or, you know, who knows what, outside with another couple hundred thousand people waiting desperately for it all to end? What's he going to tell people?
Yeah, a cold coming we had of it. I am preparing my coats and scarves and hats and layers. But 8 years ago, Donald Trump delivered an inaugural address that I think is now really remembered for two words, American carnage. And he was referring to the Rust Belt, the industrial Midwest, factories turned into tombstones, workers laid off. And how industrial policy had really caused American carnage. And of course, his critics said by the end of 4 years, he had lived American carnage himself with a pandemic, and it had come true for the United States. It'll be fascinating to see if there's a similarly dark tone in Monday's inaugural address. I suspect some of that will be there, although he actually has a rally with his supporters the previous day, when perhaps he'll get some of that out of his system. The other phrase he's been using recently at rallies is a new golden age of America. So I suspect we'll probably hear words like that and perhaps strike some more optimistic notes this time also. But look, given what he campaigned on, I think we will hear a lot about immigration and his plan to crack down on illegal immigration. Again, the first term, it was all about the border wall. This time around, it seems to be focused more on mass deportations. So it'll be notable just how much does he get into the rhetoric of blood and soil and nationalism and this idea of America for the Americans. And bearing in mind, the speech may well be at least partly written by Stephen Miller, his senior advisor. It might go down, you know, quite far down that white nationalist route, sadly. I think, obviously, you know, the economy and inflation were huge election campaign issues. I'm sure he will promise to restore greatness in the economy and create jobs, and, you know, conveniently overlook the fact that Joe Biden is actually bequeathing him a very successful economy by global standards. And, you know, we can expect to hear some culture war issues, perhaps around racial diversity, equity and inclusion programs that he's pushing back on, and transgender rights that he's pushing back on, and a few other things. And who knows what we'll hear on foreign policy, because this is a man whose political identity is built around the idea of America first and not getting involved in foreign entanglements, not starting new wars. And yet, in the last few weeks, we've also heard Donald Trump talk about buying Greenland or taking it by force, potentially, turning Canada into the 51st state and regaining the Panama Canal. So perhaps he'll have some more surprises up his sleeve for us on that score too.
Well, that's a perfect segue to the other question that's obviously hanging out there for us, and that is the ceasefire accord in the Middle East, which, depending on which side of the partisan divide you are on, is either the final achievement of the Biden presidency or Donald Trump rides to the rescue, solves and fixes everything, you know, heals the afflicted and soothes the terrified. Regardless of who claims the credit, it's been a long and bumpy and dangerous and devastating ride to get to this point. But it takes place, supposedly, it starts on Sunday, one day before the next president takes his oath of office. And it includes, as I'm sure every listener is aware now, a ceasefire for a set period of time, the exchange of some, but not all, of the remaining hostages, and a larger number of prisoners being held by the Israelis, as well as the implicit promise that there will be extended versions of this going forward until we reach that great period, that great moment of peaceful sunrise.
Yeah, yeah, and there are different things going on here. On one level, this will hopefully be an American triumph of cooperation, because the officials are saying that actually the outgoing Biden team and the incoming Trump team worked together on this pretty successfully. And that is a hopeful note in an otherwise partisan era. And for example, as you say, it's been such a rocky road, you know, inevitably, even at the end, there were problems, there were bumps in the road. There was a potential breakdown over the identity of which Palestinian prisoners would be released as part of this deal. And that led to, again, the top Biden negotiator and top Trump negotiator joining others in several hours of talks this week to iron that one out. And the State Department, for example, have given credit to the Trump team for their involvement. But, you know, inevitably, on a different level, yes, it's also becoming a game over who can claim the most credit for it. And from everything we know about Trump, he is certainly going to say this was all down to him. When a reporter asked Joe Biden about that, Biden frowned and said he must be joking. I think, you know, supporters of both will each claim it was their man who pulled it off. And, you know, it's an important thing for Biden, a very mixed record on foreign policy. He really wants this as a final victory, as a legacy issue, especially as Gaza has been so divisive in his party. And, you know, from Israel's perspective, from Netanyahu, you know, there are indications that they were not going to pay that much attention to what Biden had to say as he was departing. But once they learned the Trump team were taking a similar position, they had to wake up to that and pay more heed. I've also heard some commentary that generally Joe Biden's been fairly ineffective with Netanyahu over the last couple of years. It's seen as perceived at least as relatively weak, whereas Trump, you know, likes to project this strongman image, and certainly has had a closer relationship with Netanyahu. So the Israeli government had to take that more seriously. But I think, you know, even in the last days before this deal is implemented, we've seen Israeli bombing of Gaza continuing, and there have been fatalities. So it's a reminder this is still very fragile, and you know, things can still go wrong.
Yeah, I mean, the old Richard Nixon adage sort of floated into my mind as you were speaking, which is, you know, hold your friends close, but hold your enemies closer. And that seemed to have been the Trumpian approach to Netanyahu, or a combination of the two, really. Donald Trump sees Benjamin Netanyahu as a comrade in arms, but doesn't exactly trust him in all respects, whereas Joe Biden felt impelled to appeal to his better nature, which appeared not to have achieved the desired result. Perhaps between the two, the hammer and the anvil, maybe there was some effect on the way. But even within the Israeli cabinet, of course, the two far right fringe parties were trying to put the brake on it up until the last minutes, which had some people unnerved at the possibility that the whole edifice would just collapse as a result of all this, which appears not to have happened. But if this is the case for Gaza, Middle East, Israel, Ukraine, What does this imply for Ukraine and Russia, or alternatively China stroke Taiwan, which are the other two main, I don't want to say irritants, main crises in the making or for real that the Trump administration will have to deal with in very quick order?
And while you're talking, you gave me a fantasy of could Joe Biden and Donald Trump be a roving double act of negotiators? You know, good cop, bad cop, fixing the world's problems. We will see, but I think you know, those other situations are probably very different. And what we know about Trump is that he's transactional. And it's a lot about what's in it for him, and that's often a primary motivation. One of my worries about the Russia-Ukraine situation is that you know, Trump's recent pronouncements on or should we annex Greenland or the Panama Canal undermines American credibility on this. I mean, it's a lecture Putin on borders and sovereignty and carving up the world.
David, we're going to have to take another ad break. We're going to break off from this for a second, and we will be right back after these messages. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, your host, and my guest today, fortunately for us, David Smith, the Guardian correspondent in Washington, just before the inauguration of the next American president. We'll be back in a minute.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
I get caught out by this every, now we're live, here we go. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, your host, of course, and my guest today, very delightfully so, David Smith, The Guardian newspaper's correspondent in Washington. And we're talking, not surprisingly, about the American presidential inauguration and all the issues that pertain to it and surrounded like a giant penumbra. We were just before the break, I was asking David how the inauguration of this new president, 45th or 47th, depending on your calculations, is going to play out against the current war in Ukraine, Russia's invasion thereof, or the potential for the Chinese to make a more significant move against Taiwan, given, and you quite rightly said, given the nature of the Trumpian discourse that says the United States should take over Greenland, the Panama Canal, Canada. I mean, the only thing left, I guess, was a couple of Pacific islands that nobody else has claimed. But what are people saying that you talk to in Washington? How is the effect going to shape up on those issues internationally?
It's funny. I think there is some optimism, cautiously, around Ukraine and Russia, just from the point of view that something has to change. And you actually hear the sentiment expressed from Kyiv that they're obviously grateful for Joe Biden's support, but it was not fast enough. It was not strong enough. It's force them into this limbo, this status quo, this grind month after month. And I think there's a hope that Trump will come along and shake things up one way or another. That may, of course, prove to be wildly optimistic, because if he continues his apparent affinity with Vladimir Putin and suggests a negotiation that strongly favors Russia, then that will not go down so well. And certainly hovering over this is the very long-running story, of course, of Trump's relationship with Russia. What is this mysterious affinity he has with Putin, and how is that going to factor into the Ukraine situation? Trump claimed on the campaign trail that he could end this war on day one. I think even he is now backpedaling from that a bit. And on that, on many other issues, when you make very bold promises, now there's likely to be disappointment if he doesn't deliver. I think Trump also seems to have this admiration for President Xi of China, and Trump is a guy who loves military parades and putting his name on buildings and uniforms and tanks and crude symbols of masculinity like that. So he has spoken admiringly of the way Xi has military parades and is supposedly strong and powerful. I mean, this is not a great recipe for democracy. So perhaps some will be glad that he and Xi can talk and establish some kind of personal rapport. But certainly in some quarters, I hear quite a lot of pessimism about the defense of Taiwan. They find it fairly incredible to believe that Trump could find Taiwan on a map, that he would care about it, that he would see any real US interest in, we're talking about literally, sending troops, military assets to defend Taiwan. Now, Joe Biden broke from the policy of strategic ambiguity to quite explicitly say that, yes, he would defend Taiwan militarily. And I think it will be fascinating if and when Trump gets asked that same question at a press conference or an interview, would you defend Taiwan, even involving the US military? And a man who's run on America First, who has very strong pressures from his right wing to stay out of that kind of conflict, may well answer in the negative. So yeah, I generally hear quite a lot of pessimism around what the Trump presidency means for Taiwan.
I mean, you used the phrase strategic ambiguity, and that was implicit in the original Taiwan Relations Act going back to what, 1979, I think, in which it was assumed that certain things would happen, but it was never explicitly said. And quite rightly, as you point out, Joe Biden said those things. And strategic ambiguity is, by most people's light, something of a positive. The gloomier version is the crazy uncle locked in the attic who was let out once in a while for dinner.
But you're
And
reminding me, yeah, I mean, you're reminding me another resonant phrase from the past, of course, is the madman theory, pioneered by Nixon. And one could make the case Trump is a very good exponent of that, because sometimes he actually does seem quite mad, or certainly very volatile and unpredictable. And the idea of this theory is that you are so unpredictable, you're political opponent, your strategic foe can't quite know how you're going to respond to something, and therefore they're obliged to be extra cautious, and you constantly keep them guessing, keep them on their toes. And we saw some of that from Trump in his first term. I think again the Canada Green and Panama Canal is part of this. If you're trying to make a positive argument in favor of Trump, you would say countries such as China and Russia will be nervous and cautious because they felt fairly confident what Joe Biden would do in a situation based on decades of foreign policy experience. Whereas Trump is a guy who writes crazy things on social media at 2 o'clock in the morning. He hires and fires people. He's constantly full of surprises. What if he actually did launch a war or launch a missile or do something unexpected? And he did sometimes kill terrorists unexpectedly and do things in the foreign policy arena that were unorthodox first time around. And if you were, as I say, if you were sort of defending Trump, you would say, well, for example, China will probably may not dare invade Taiwan because it just can't quite be sure how Trump would respond to that.
David, we're going to take another ad break. Got to pay that piper. We have to do these things. You in the audience, please don't touch that dial. Stay with us. This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector. David Smith, Washington correspondent for The Guardian newspapers, is with us this morning, and we're doing all things American foreign policy, the inauguration of the new president, the peace accord, the ceasefire accord in the Middle East, and we'll be right back after these messages.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And we are back. And this is Brooke Spector, your host. The Deep Dive is the program. And today's guest, Washington correspondent for The Guardian newspapers, David Smith, old friend and valued associate. He was in Africa for many years where we got to know him. And I think he probably, more than most foreign correspondents, that he visited most of the countries on the continent that were within his geographical area. He must have had a heck of a drawer filled with leftover currency and coins from all manner of places, which he could never quite figure out what to do with, although children may actually inherit that. And now he's ensconced in Washington, where on Monday he's going to have three layers of clothing, two pairs of gloves, a hat, a muff, probably earmuffs as well, and you know, heavy-duty boots and three pairs of socks. Sitting outside watching Donald Trump be inaugurated as the new American president. We were talking just before the break about this sense of strategic ambiguity and the way in which it translates into policy choices, or the fact that it may precipitate unexpected choices. And I had this suddenly had this vision of Donald Trump, the supreme example of strategic ambiguity, or the madman theory, as Richard Nixon used to refer to it, locked in an embrace with an equally strategically ambiguous man in Moscow or perhaps in Beijing. That opens up the doors to all manner of possible misunderstandings as well as opportunities. I mean, you know, you bet big and you may win lots or you may lose everything.
Yeah, it's a very fragile, volatile moment. I think foreign leaders around the world are Trump-proofing. They have at least had one term of this to prepare. They know he's going to potentially try and shake up NATO again, or you know, potentially undermine NATO and test all sorts of other alliances. I mean, Joe Biden loved to tell this story about meeting foreign leaders and reassuring them, you know, America is back. And one of them turned to him and said, yes, but for how long? And now, of course, we had the answer, which was 4 years, and now those leaders will be confronting Donald Trump again, who famously, at least one summit, do you remember, shoved aside the prime minister of one country. So I think the rest of the world is, at least some of them are saying, you know, we can no longer necessarily depend on America. Europe, for example, has to deal with its own defense to a greater degree, another factor I'll be watching in all of this when we talk about foreign policy is the role of Elon Musk, the world's richest man and certainly one of the most powerful. I mean, extraordinarily in the transition, he apparently has been in the room and on phone calls with Zelensky in Ukraine, and he's also been interfering in British and German politics, throwing his weight behind far-right parties. So that's a key difference, I think, in the second Trump term. And, the world is scratching its head and wondering, how to deal with this.
David, we're running out of time, but I'm going to ask you for some quick final words. But I do want to, my hat's off to you for your perseverance in going 2 days, 3 days from now, going to sit outside for what will probably be hours and hours of Washington winter weather, past all the security gates and all the body checks and everything, to find your seat in the vast open spaces of the Capitol Mall, while you wait for Hail to the chief, ruffles and flourishes, and swearing in of the new president, and then a speech which everybody will be listening to hear just exactly what it is Mr. Trump has in mind. And I guess we'll all be watching, too, to see if there are any protests, any demonstrations by people, any loud noises of disagreement.
Yes, I mean, I think that's one of the interesting aspects of this moment, the resistance to Trump. That was very vibrant in 2017, most famously with the Women's March, which was the biggest protest ever on the streets up to that point, later eclipsed by the Black Lives Matter protests over George Floyd. Now, this coming Saturday, there is a People's March planned for Washington. I think everybody expects that to be a much smaller crowd. And that will be symbolic, perhaps, of how the anti-Trump resistance feels more muted this time, just less enthusiastic, less vocal. Meanwhile, we see business leaders bending the knee to Trump, what some are calling a great capitulation. Where do the Democrats go from here in that context?
David, we're going to have to close it off. I appreciate your time. We have to make way for the next program. This has been The Deep Dive with your host, Brooke Spector, and my special guest, Washington correspondent for The Guardian newspapers, David Smith. And good luck on Monday. And we hope to talk to you again once things clear up in Washington and we understand where everybody is going and to do and what it is they're going to be doing. You take care. And to my audience, please, you have a good weekend. You take care of yourselves.